Well, so it's actually a really nice linkage between the two talks. You know, this last talk really focused on total multifunctionality and was really looking at these very diverse mixtures. And what I'm going to do is kind of narrow in a bit more and really focus on specific traits and working with much less species. You know, something that's a little bit more controllable, a little more manageable, two species that we have a little bit more ability to create specific manipulations and gradients with. And so I'm going to kind of focus on more like trade-offs between one or two traits and go through a few of them and find and talk about some of where that optimization occurs rather than kind of creating a full multi-criteria assessment. So I think it's nice to see that those differences. Charlie certainly set the tone for what we're looking for. These are multifunctional tools. They provide a whole host of different services. Let me find my little laser pointer here. Okay, good. So these are not the laundry list of services that we're targeting, but certainly most of the services, many of the services that we're looking for from our cover crops. And just think of this very simple schematic as you know, cover crops are at the center of the universe, and these arrows represent the extent to which a cover crop provides that benefit. And this is just all very subjective here. You know, we don't have cover crops that actually do that, right? We don't have one cover crop that provides all of these services. So this is not some ultimate cover crop that I've been keeping a secret from everybody that nobody has access to. No, none of our cover crops do this. So this is just in theory, you know, we're targeting all these services and we'd hope to achieve a lot of these, but we can't really do that with one species. And so that's part of where we're going with this multi-species systems. So what are we looking for from a cover crop based system? I think these are some of the key points. These are the types of things that I would like to see from our cover cropping systems. You know, we want to first and foremost maximize profitability. If we're not profitable, you know, then we're not sustainable. That's one of the key of those three-legged stools, and we need to focus on that. Improving our production use efficiency is very important. Tightening the nutrient cycling, increasing water use efficiency, labor, fuel. Minimizing the development of herbicide resistance, that's a big issue as well, and that's coming up more and more, you know, where cover crops were not really sought after as a tool in conventional agriculture for weed management because of this every five-year cycle of renewed options. Those options, as they're running out, cover crops are being sought after as a very important tool, and so we're starting to see a lot of interest in cover crops from this for that need as well. Conserving soil and water resources, there's a lot of historical, you know, interest in cover crops for those reasons, obviously reducing erosion and addressing water quality. Increasing soil health is something now that's receiving a lot of attention, right? We moved from soil conservation to soil quality. Now we call it soil health, and that's kind of the big buzz of the day, and that's what we're focusing a lot on with reduced tillage and cover crops. But here's another one that we want to really focus on with our cover crop-based systems. You know, with changing climates, increased, you know, droughts, increased floods, cover crops serve to help mediate that and to help our systems be more resilient to climate change, as well as reducing the amount of reactive nitrogen in the landscape, which also is a potential concern for greenhouse gases. So here's a very simple qualitative way of looking at cover crops. And we're going to come back to this because I'm going to dive a little bit deeper into this biomass piece here, but I think this is a pretty accurate point. You know, we're focusing so much on cover crops, but how they perform and the services we get really is driven by biomass. It's kind of this ultimate indicator of service. And so when we have these small little cover crops in the landscape, sure, we're going to get some erosion control. We might even get some water quality benefits. But it's really when we push that biomass that we start to pick up more and more services. And so while this is just me dropping pictures along a scale where I think they belong, I don't think this is very far off. So now I flipped the schematic that you were looking at earlier, so just to confuse you. Now, cover crops are still at the center of the universe, but the arrows are pointing in. And we're not looking at agroecosystem services, we're looking at factors of management that drive the performance of the cover crop. And so, you know, cover crops are just like our cash crops. They respond to all of the same things that our cash crops respond to, and those conditions drive their performance. And so if we want cover crops to become more utilized in the landscape, if we want to be able to make recommendations to growers, we're never going to be putting down a cover crop like we spray a herbicide or the precision of a mineral fertilizer. But if we want more cover crop adoption, we want to be able to make recommendations where we're increasing that precision, we need to focus on management. And all of these factors drive how well a cover crop performs, its consistency, and our ability to understand and make recommendations. So obviously the symposium today is about mixtures. So I'm going to focus in on manipulating the performance through looking at cover crop mixtures. So here's just two factors that we're interested in optimizing on, right? You know, weed control is a concern in agriculture, nitrogen management is a concern, and we try to address those concerns with cover crops. Now, we don't have one species maximizing all of these different benefits. So again, now, just to confuse you some more, I flipped this figure out again. So now we're not looking at that management piece, we're looking back at agroecosystem services and the cover crop arrows going out. And this is just a qualitative interpretation of the extent to which a legume provides a service and a cereal provides a service. And clearly, there are differences. There's these trade-offs. Whenever we have a management objective in agriculture, we know we have multiple objectives and we know there are trade-offs in the decisions we make with our management. And cover crop mixtures provide us an opportunity to try to address those trade-offs and hit multiple services. So for example, this nutrient supply versus weed control piece. We know that grasses are really good at suppressing weeds, but we also know that they tie up a lot of nitrogen and they certainly don't provide a lot of nitrogen. In the case of legumes, we know that we get very low weed suppression benefits from legumes, but we certainly get a lot of nitrogen from those legumes. So here are two functional traits, as Charlie would call them, that are providing specific services, and one of them provides one service better than the other. So when we combine them, that's when we can start to try to address multiple services. So we set up this experiment. We have about 3 or 4 site years of this experiment, and we did this on both an organic, a long-term managed, organically managed site and a conventional site. So we have, you're going to see dual data sets for both the conventional systems and the organic systems. And what we wanted to do is create a response surface of these mixtures. So we have pure, well, the bare ground, obviously no cover crop. But then we have this pure cereal rye, and we have this pure hairy vetch. And these are these seeding rate replacement series that we have here to create a continuum of a grass-legume mixture. So obviously, as you increase your legume, you decrease your rye, it has a collection of effects on the composition of that cover crop and the benefits it provides. So let's look at the biomass. Again, here on this x-axis, this is a hairy vetch cereal rye seeding rate. So the 0 represents 0 hairy vetch, and over here the 1 represents 100%. And over here the 0 represents 0 cereal rye, and you can see cereal rye is increasing that way. Right? So vetch is increasing this direction. Here's vetch increasing, and rye is increasing this way. And this is our total biomass. And here's our monocultures. So here's our monoculture rye, our monoculture vetch. A number of these figures, I'm going to be going through this data set through the whole presentation, so just, you know, get yourself kind of cued into how this axis works, because this is a collection of work that really came from a number of students' efforts, but really predominantly Hannah Poffenbarger and Brian Davis's master's and PhD thesis work. There's some differences in how we describe this, whether it's 100% and 0 versus 0 and 1. Some different scaling there, but it's all the same thing, you know, these ratios of these cover crops. And so now here we're looking at 6 site years of data. This is 3 site years on the north farm and 3 site years on the south farm, and the south farm is conventionally managed and the north farm is organically managed. And so there's several things that pop out when you look at this, right? The first thing that I want to cue you into is that all of these cover crops were seeded at the exact same rates. Their planting dates varied slightly from year to year. I mean, and within a given year, we didn't have very big differences between when we planted the north farm and the south farm. But from year to year, there were some slight variations. But the seed genetics, the seeding rates, were identical every site year in this experiment, And look at the differences in these response surfaces that you see. You've got years where vetch is fairly competitive and aggressive, and it takes off quickly. You have years where the vetch is very slow to get going, and the rye is dominating. Look at this. This is only about 20% rye, and it's dominating the site very early on. I mean, at that low seeding rate level. So there's big effects of site conditions. The initial state conditions in a field drive this composition. And so, you know, these are biological tools, right? They don't behave like a mineral fertilizer. They don't behave like a herbicide. They respond to their environment. And so if we're going to start recommending mixtures, if we're going to want to see growers use mixtures, we need to be able to understand how they behave and a host of different initial state conditions and environments so that we can be able to make at least some educated recommendations on what they would expect to see. Because right now, I could tell a farmer to do something and they could have six different responses from the same exact seeding rate in their fields. And they know that intrinsically about their fields, right? Farmers know when they have a wet field, they know when they have a low fertility site, they know when they have a high fertility site, differences in texture. These are things that they're managing this multivariate analysis all the time in their head. And so we just need to be able to provide some guiding principles on how these initial state conditions drive performance so that we can make better recommendations. If a farmer, and I'm sorry, I'm going to get off the microphone for 1 second, I'm getting dry. If a farmer is on a high fertility site, then their grass cover crops are going to tend to dominate, right? Because grasses love nitrogen, and if you've got a lot of nitrogen in the field, your legume, it doesn't have that competitive advantage. But if you have a low fertility site, that legume is going to dominate. So that's just a simple example of a state condition that drives performance. And we need to be able to quantify more and more of these state conditions across different climate regimes so that we can be able to make better recommendations. By the way, just one more point here. So, you know, while we are looking at both organic and conventional systems here, these are definitely big biomass crops, right? We're working with really big biomass crops. So this is killing these cover crops, you know, at maturity. So we're not working with an early kill. This is really trying to push the benefits of these cover crops. So most of these slides are going to be looking at kind of these big biomass producing cover crops. Now let's see how this plays out for the nitrogen. So this is, we just looked at the biomass. Now we're going to look at shoot nitrogen content. And so the red represents your total nitrogen. Your blue represents the nitrogen in the vetch. So obviously zero vetch, as you increase your vetch biomass, you literally increase your nitrogen. Rye doesn't behave that way. Rye doesn't have, a lot of luxury consumption of N. It has some, but rye will take up a lot of its N early on, and then it'll just be assimilating carbon, and it'll be translocating. So there's not that much N uptake across these gradients, and it's certainly not a lot of N in those shoots to begin with. And these dashed line is just because we also did some biological N fixation work, but I'm not going to get into too much of that today. But you can see the key thing I want you to zero in on is that look at what happens at where you reach the monoculture vetch, right? So here's the monoculture vetch. That is what we would expect to be our maximum nitrogen content, right? Your big legume biomass is going to have a lot of N in it, and we expect it to have the most N. But when we look across this gradient, and remember now, you're looking at raw data, so, you know, cover crops respond to their environment. Even though we put out seeding rates of these different ratios, that's not what we get in the field, right? You could put out an 80-20 seeding rate, but the actual expression of that is dependent on the initial state conditions, if you have a high fertility site or a low fertility site. So you can see there's regions where we didn't span in this response surface in some years because they were just a high fertility site, right? Then the rye tended to dominate, and so we didn't get a lot into some of these later these ranges here. But what I think is really compelling here is that once you reach about 50% legume in the biomass, right? So 50% of your mixture is composed of a legume. You achieve equal nitrogen content to a pure legume. So the total N in this mixture, 50-50, is equivalent to the monoculture legume But obviously the quality is different. And that's going to obviously affect how that nitrogen behaves once this cover crop is killed. Well, when we think about nutrient management, and we have lots of talks all the time about nutrient management, there's huge sections on nutrient management. The four R's are these principles that guide a lot of our decision making, this right rate, source, time, and placement. This is what goes into thinking about how to, you know, have best use efficiency of our nutrients. We want to reduce the amount of leaching and erosion and minimize volatilization and obviously increase this use efficiency so that we can, one, reduce loading of nutrients in the environment, reduce costs over time, and reduce the potential implications on water quality issues. So when we think about nutrient use efficiency, there's a reason why we side dress our corn, right? All of us are pretty familiar with this. When corn is taking up nitrogen, there's a point in which it starts to exponentially take up nitrogen. It's really rapid. And that period when it's exponentially taking up nitrogen, that's when we want our nitrogen in the landscape, right? We don't want all our nitrogen out here early on because there's nothing there taking it up. And so that's very vulnerable to leaching. And so part of getting a more better use efficiency out of our nutrient applications is we have these split applications of low fertility at starter, and we have a side dress to help kind of get that better use efficiency. And why not try to apply those principles to organic amendments? Cover crops are certainly going to have different release rates, but to be able to understand how they release those nutrients and to synchronize that with an uptake gets better use efficiency and tightens up the system. So Hannah embarked upon this monster project to look at the decomposition of cover crops and all of these different treatments that we've been talking about. But now we're looking at a slightly different ratio. We didn't want to do the 6 or 7 ratio, so we brought it down to 5. So you're just going to see a slightly different numbers here. Go back. So instead of it being, instead of it being these 20 and 80s and 60 and 40s, we did a 0, 25, 50, 75, and 100% ranges. So that's what you'll be seeing. So if you're it is the same experiment, but the cover crops we put into those treatments, it was a slightly different rate. So as you'd expect, that the quality of these cover crops are affected by the composition. As you increase from going from no hairy vetch to increasing hairy vetch, you're going to change the CN ratios. Obviously, remember I talked earlier about we didn't always span that range because of what was the expressed biomass in the field. But again, the point here is just that you get this continuum of CN ratios, and we all know that these mineralization immobilization transformations are occurring around this range. So this is where we're maximizing N release. This is where we're starting to get immobilization. Here's your pure cereal rye. And so how does that behave? Here is mass remaining. So this is like a proportional loss, a decomposition of this biomass. And here you're looking at degree days and also days of termination. And this is just a small slice. The paper is out. Feel free to go and look at that. There's a lot of different variants we did on mixtures and with poultry litter. But the point here is that here's our pure vetch, here's our pure rye, and you can see this continuum of the different mixtures following those CN ratios. As you lowered the CN ratios, you had much more loss of the cover crop. And you can also see that, I labeled this incorrectly. So I just put that in there this morning because I didn't think that this was clear enough. And of course I added, I confused you. But this is the cereal rye. This is the pure vetch. So vetch is decomposing rapidly. Rye is decomposing slowly. Sorry about that. So now this is more of a user-friendly visual tool of kind of understanding what's going on with these cover crops as they decay. So here is a tillage-based approach. So in this systems experiment that we did, we had till and no-till treatments. And so we're going to look at both of that. So here's the pure hairy vetch, a 50-50 mixture, and pure rye. And this is time here on the x-axis. And you can see that you get a dramatic release of the vetch early. So it's really important for folks who are just getting involved with cover crops or are not familiar with the decomposition kinetics of cover crops to know that legumes provide just as much of an opportunity of a nutrient issue, a nutrient loss issue, and a water quality issue. Legumes decompose rapidly. Look at this. This is like 12 to 15 days, the vast majority of the nitrogen in that tissue. is soluble and leachable. So legumes are exploding nitrogen into the field very rapidly, and it's particularly when they're incorporated, when you're in the soil, you have this very stable moisture and temperature. So it's the optimal conditions for decomposition. The grass mixture obviously slows that down and also gives you a little bit better synchrony, but you reduce the overall amount of nitrogen release. So even though this 50-50, if you remember from earlier, had the same amount of total nitrogen in the biomass, the release rate is very different. The amount of nitrogen that you realize during that growing season is different because you have a much slower release of that product. And then the pure cereal rye, there's really not much change there in the end coming out of that product because there's just not a lot of nitrogen in these big rye cover crops. Now here's a no-till environment. And you can see this is an opportunity to get a much better synchrony with your nitrogen management. When you have cover crops on the surface, it really slows down that decomposition kinetics and you get better synchrony from the mixtures as well as the pure hairy vetch. But the point here is that these surface residues are in an inhospitable condition, right? You go through extreme wetting and extreme dry. You go through very hot conditions and cool conditions. Daily, these diurnal dynamics are happening all the time. That's not very conducive for fungi and bacteria to decompose this material, and so you get a slower decomposition of that material. Either way, generally, we do not get enough nitrogen from our cover crops to fully support the production of a corn crop. So we need to supplement that fertility. So the next phase of this presentation is looking at how we combine our understanding and management of these mixtures with other sources of fertility and how we can optimize this weed nitrogen dynamic that I was talking about earlier. So we looked at a couple of products. We have a lot of poo in our area. Poultry litter is widely abundant in the region, and so we wanted to get a good handle on how that is interacting in this system. We also have a mineral fertilizer control in this study, but we really wanted to get a handle. There's a lot of poultry litter in the region. We want to look at how they're performing with these cover crop mixtures. There's a lot of concerns about phosphorus management in our region. When it comes to all these organic nutrient sources, we have regulation now in Maryland where poultry litter has to be incorporated within 48 hours. So you can't just spin this on the surface and leave it there. And that provides a whole nother management challenge. I mean, it's especially if we're trying to promote a very important production practice, no-till agriculture, right? It's an important conservation strategy. There's a lot of other benefits associated with it, and we want to maintain that no-till agricultural system. But now we have, how do we get our poo into the system? And so that's the next phase challenge. And then there's also some cautionary coming around that are focusing on injection. Now with dairy manure, they've really ramped this up already. There's a lot of folks using liquid dairy injection technology. It's working well. It's easy to inject a liquid. But working with poultry litter, that's a whole other beast. That's a real challenge to get that below the soil surface. So we built this machine. It's certainly not production scale ready. This is not what your farmer is going to see and get excited about, unless you have a vegetable operation, which I think this is ready to go for vegetable production. But for large scale production agriculture, corn and soybean production, this is not a tool that's going to work. I'm not an ag engineer. I'm a biologist, and I want to test principles. And so I wanted to design a machine that can uniformly put poultry litter below the soil surface and band it. So we have this unit here that bands the poultry litter below the soil surface. And I wanted to be able to get closer to that concept of managing like a conventional farmer would, where they're thinking about this use efficiency and they're doing these split applications. So a machine that can do this at side dress. This is, again, this is not ready to go for prime time for production. I'm working with pellets. That's the reason why I was able to get this to work, is pellets are dry. It's very easy to get a very precise rate and a uniform rate. So while pellets and bulk litter, maybe you're not familiar, but Purdue is agribusiness has developed this product from their poultry litter where they're now drying, compressing, and sterilizing poultry litter into these pellets. And so there's a way of being able to ship that product further. And so they're quite abundant in our region, but they're not widely used at all by field crop producers because it's too expensive. But their decomposition kinetics, their nitrogen release, behave pretty much identical to bulk litter. So from a researcher's standpoint, asking the questions I want to ask, bulk litter is an ag engineering challenge, and there's a lot of folks working on that. But from my perspective, I want to be able to put this in a system and test the biology and say, is there advantages in these use efficiencies? So we fabricated this machine. It allows us to subsurface ban poultry litter, and here's what that looks like. So it puts a ban about 4 inches below the soil surface, and it's this beautiful little plug about this big, and we can put anywhere from 3/4 ton all the way up to 6 ton in there and put it about 4 inches below the soil surface and have the ability to do this at planting versus at side dress. So here's the treatments that we added on top of that cover crop mixture gradient. So remember those different response surfaces of grasses and legumes? Now we have some different fertility treatments added as well. We're looking at the major question we wanted to test was the subsurface banding poultry litter. So that's this response surface here that we created. And just ignore these organic and conventional. It's an artifact of some other points that we were trying to make, but we created a gradient of nitrogen from poultry litter, and then we did some contrasts. We wanted to show that broadcasting poultry litter, which is what historically was done, but we're not permitted to do in the state of Maryland anymore, is just put poultry litter on the top of our cover crop and keep going. And then we have incorporated, which is more of a tillage-based system. So here now we've actually tilled, incorporated our cover crop, as well as incorporated the poultry litter. And it's all at this pea removal rate here. So this is our pea removal rate. Remember, Charlie was talking earlier about trying to have better sustainable nutrient management with our animal byproducts. So this is at the pea removal level. This is at the N removal level. And this is just because we're crazy. So let's just look at a little bit how this behaves. So this is another paper that's come out recently, Poffenbarger et al. And here she did an extensive evaluation of the spatiotemporal availability of nitrogen around this, the different treatments that we had out there. And so I'm just narrowing in on a few of them, okay? This is just the banded system. So, you know, we had all those other treatments, right? We had banded, but we also had broadcast and incorporated. So Hannah looked at all of that. All I'm showing you is just to give you a little taste of how this behaves, how the band behaves in the soil. So this is our pure cereal rye, and this is thyme, right? This is just corn growth stages. And this is vetch, and this is mixture of the two. And this is where side dress occurred. Can you see the band? Yeah, right there. So it really pops. And so you can see the behavior of the nitrogen from the band. You can see the contributions of the cover crop early on before the band, and then you can see how that plays out. And what's really interesting about this band and how it behaves is that it doesn't move much. Look at how you just see red underneath that band all throughout here. If that's red for folks, maroon, purple. There's very little movement that nitrogen is basically staying tightly in that band because the corn roots are populating all into that band and taking up nitrogen from that poultry litter as it's releasing. So that's why you see it very concentrated here and just diluting over time in the amount of soil inorganic nitrogen. So this is all soil inorganic nitrogen, and you're just seeing a reduction in it. But you don't see a lot of diffusion away from that band. And then you can also just see some of the broader effects of the cereal rye versus the vetch and how that affects soil nitrogen in the system. So let's look at a couple of these treatments. We're looking at grain yield right now, and what you're looking at is across that continuum of the grass legume mixtures. Remember, this is our pure rye, this is our pure vetch, this is the conventional system, where we're using a mineral fertilizer versus the subsurface banded poultry litter. And isn't that nice? Not very big differences from subsurface banding versus the UAN rate, looking at, this is the N-base rate, looking at the yield potential. And this bare ground just shows the distribution of the yields coming from those two treatments. And I think the other point to cue into here, obviously, is that when you have these high fertility rates, you can see that even at our low vetch, you know, this is like our pure rye here, and this is basically 80% rye biomass, we are starting to max out on our yields early on. So that's an important concept because depending on how much nitrogen we apply, that's going to affect what the yield performance is going to be based on the composition of the cover crop. And if we're wanting another service like weed suppression from our rye, being able to max out yields is an important goal. And so where that occurs and having more flexibility is what we're seeing here, is that you have a fair bit of flexibility when you fertilize at that high rate. So now let's look at the three different rates. So this is no poultry litter. So this is just the contributions of the cover crop. So this is if you're pure rye, this is your pure vetch, this is your yield potential, and this is the bare ground. So that's just the contributions of the soil and or here in the case of the poultry litter. So you can see we're at a site that has long-term management of cover crops and manures, and so there's a fairly good base fertility. And we saw a number of presentations, you know, from the Midwest where they have really good soils in these cover crop sections where the bare grounds had fairly high yields and they were relying on that mineral fertilizer, the soil mineralization, right? So that's what you're seeing here, this is the yield potential. And so when you have pure rye, that was lowering the yield potential. But then the P base rate, you can see you had a steady increase across that vetch gradient. So even at the P base rate, we didn't start to really maximize and achieve comparable yields to the end base rates until we got to about 80% hairy vetch in that biomass mixture. And the end base rate goes back to that figure I showed you earlier. You've got a much wider range of a cover crop mixture that you can still maintain maximum yields at if you are applying your poultry litter at the end base rate. So now this is where it gets a little dicey, and I'm hoping to get some conversation from everybody in the room about this, because we're struggling to figure out how to quantify nitrogen use efficiency in these systems. You know, when you're working with a lot of these organic amendments, it's a little bit trickier to calculate NUE, right? So this is a simple, there are many ways to calculate NUE, but here we're doing it from grain nitrogen. So this is the nitrogen that's in the grain, and it's from a plot that had a cover crop and the poultry litter. So this is kind of our multiple fertility, cover crop and poultry litter. And then we subtracted out the nitrogen content in grain that came from a plot that was just on a cover crop treatment, the same cover crop treatment. And we did this for a specific reason. The bare ground didn't seem like a fair treatment to use. Normally, when you calculate NUE, you would use your no nutrient applied is what you're going to be subtracting from your grain nitrogen to get your nitrogen use efficiency. But we know that the presence of a cover crop itself affects the soil moisture, the temperature, and the mineralization and nutrient cycling in the soil. So if we put bare ground as what we were subtracting from, we're going to really inflate our values because we're going to be working with a bare ground which is going to have much different nitrogen cycling than our cover crop plots. So it limits what we can say, right? Because we can't look at all this iterations of cover crop and manure treatments. And so we can only look at a limited set of responses. And so this is our first cut at this. We pooled several of the years. We're looking at confident intervals. This is really fresh off the press. So we still have a lot of dissecting to do to break this apart and understand what's going on here. So I don't want to spend a lot of time, but the point here is you can see obviously that the most obvious trend is that the more nitrogen you add into a system, you expect to have lower nitrogen use efficiency, right? More N, you're going to always have a less N uptake as you add nitrogen. So you expect this slope here to go down. And it does seem that we are seeing some differences in use efficiency at the P-based and N-based rates. So we have some work to do to figure out how to best express this and how to slice this up. I would love feedback from the room when we get into the discussion. But we're hoping to kind of start to break this apart a bit more, look at some of the different interactions, and get a better handle. And maybe NUE with organic amendments is not a really useful criteria. Maybe we really can't be, you know, looking at this use efficiency question because of the fact that we just have all of these confounding dynamics going on that make it harder than looking at just amendment A, B, and C in bare ground like we do with mineral fertilizers. Now let's look at this weed response. And I love this slide. We had 2 years of this, and this is the organic site. Obviously, the conventional site didn't have weeds. We don't have herbicide resistance in that field, so they're pretty spotless. So you were just looking at N dynamics. Now we're looking at the organic site that allows us to look at a weed response. So the weed response you see here would certainly be very comparable to what you would see if you had resistance, right? If your herbicide program wasn't working, those weeds that have resistance would respond in this way. And look, what you're looking across here is the growth stages of corn. So this is when corn is small, this is when corn is going reproductive, and these colors represent the different ratios of the cover crop mixtures. The pure blue is 100% rye, and the pure red is 100% vetch, and this is wheat biomass. And what pops is really interesting here. Vetch just not just is a poor suppressor, but it's stimulating weeds. We're getting a tremendous amount of wheat biomass, and we're getting it early. And what I really think is fascinating here is that it doesn't take much rye. That even a very low level of cereal rye is having a dramatic effect on our weed performance in this system. And so now I'm gonna speculate. I don't have data to support this. We've got some samples that we've collected. But what I think is going on there is that it's not just the CN ratios of the cover crops. It's the contact with the surface. Legumes are prostrate, the vetch is prostrate, it's touching the ground. When you go into a hairy vetch biomass, when it's fairly mature, the underlayer of that cover crop is melting down. It's decomposing, it's slimy, it's wet, it's hot. It's releasing all these nitrogenous compounds, which we know stimulate weeds to germinate. And so what I suspect is going on here is a couple of things. One is that, yes, rye is a better weed suppressor, sure. But I think that it's also the structure, that you have a legume lying on the ground making contact with the fungi, making contact with the bacteria that at the soil surface, and which is speeding up decomposition, and then you know that as that cover crop is decomposing, you're getting pulses of microbial biomass, right? That's exploding because it's getting all this nitrogen. And so that decomposition is then going to just have positive feedback loop and increase decomposition, reduce the quality and integrity of that mulch for weed suppression, but it's also going to stimulate these weeds as it's decomposing early. And early is like well before we plant our cash crop. This is going on like weeks and weeks before we plant our cash crop. So there's a lot of things going on there. You got my speculation of what I think some of them are. And then we look at the yields now on this organic site. This is a little bit of difference. So this is a traditional organic system, right? This is a tillage-based system. We had a dry year, and so you can see the effects of water in this system, right? You've got a lot of tillage and cultivation, and so across this cover crop gradient, we had poor yields in the tillage-based system. So this is managed with rotary hose, between row cultivations, and this is, you know, the weed response. This is the yield response we got from this incorporated treatment. And these are the yield response that we got from the broadcast and incorporated. So this is where we broadcast the poultry litter over the soil surface, or we banded it. I'm sorry, I messed you up there. Broadcast versus subsurface banded are these top two, right? So we banded, in the case of the blue, subsurface banded into those heavy residues versus just broadcasted the manure on the surface. The reason these blue here is so low is because this is bare ground. This is an organic system. We're not using herbicides. So, you know, organic no-till doesn't work that fabulously on a good day, and if you've got no cover crop there, it's going to work really poorly because it's just going to become a weedy mess. So this is corn yields basically in a jungle of weeds, whereas this is kind of more the yield potentials up here with better weed, you know, weed management. But what pops is that's where all our weeds were, right? When you remember seeing those mixture gradients, where what was stimulating the most weed biomass was that pure hairy vetch. That this is the pure hairy vetch. So when you have all that stimulated weed biomass from that hairy vetch cover crop, that translates into our corn yields, as you would expect. So coming back to these cover crop-based cropping systems and what we're trying to do in these cover crop-based cropping systems. Another point that I didn't highlight is this bottom one here of mitigating against and adapting to climate change. I've covered some of these above. So here's some work that we did in this experiment as well, where we were looking at the greenhouse gas emissions coming out of these mixtures. And so what I really want to cue you into is first the x-axis. So this is total N input. And the N input comes from both our cover crop residues and the poultry litter. So the nitrogen gradient there was from that subsurface banded gradient of nitrogen from the manure that we applied, and then also what was composed in the cover crop mixtures. And you can see that at these more typical rates, like this range here, more typical fertility rates that you would apply in the landscape, the vetch really pops up in a significantly higher nitrous oxide emissions than the bare ground. So here's our bare ground. The solid line is the bare ground. So at these ranges, we have much more nitrous oxide emissions than we do the bare ground. And while the mixture is not significantly different than the bare ground, isn't that nice? We're able to have a mixture that has comparable end content as our pure hairy vetch, but has a dramatic reduction in the overall nitrous oxide emissions coming out of the system. And then here's our pure sterile rye down here. So obviously, if you're fertilizing at those higher at those rates where you're putting down the N-based rates of manure and you're maximizing yields, you're still getting a really big reduction in overall nitrous oxide emissions. So I would like to just put a twist on that slide I made earlier. You know, biomass is really interesting. The quality of this biomass really matters. And we need to have a better handle on quality and quantity, right? If we want to just understand what's going on with cover crops in the landscape, we just really need two criteria. It's this quantity and this quality, because it's driving a lot of these services that we're talking about. And so part of what I wanted to do from this work is then to start working with some process-based modelers so that we can provide decision support tools to growers for their N management, really to make adaptive nitrogen management decisions. So at that time, the Cornell Adapt N model was a public tool, and I was working with the modeler at Cornell to look at our decomposition results and what their model was estimating so that hopefully we could start to provide real-time decision support to growers on their N management. And so don't look at all of what's going on here. Just know that the black lines are what was measured and the red lines are what was simulated. So the black lines are from Hannah's experiment that I showed you in this presentation, and the model produced these red lines. And these are the 100% vetch, this is 75% vetch, 50% vetch, 25%, and pure rye. And you notice there's a region where some of this breaks down, where it doesn't really, the model doesn't behave as well. And what we speculate is that this has a lot to do with the quality of the cover crop. That thinking about cover crops just on a carbon to nitrogen ratio is probably a narrow way to think about quality. We know all carbon and nitrogen is not created equal. And so we need to move past this thinking of this C-N ratios and have a better assessment of the quality of that material. And so that's where these next phase of research is going. And so I'm just going to close with. So some of the future work we're interested in with mixtures is certainly to continue questions related to herbicide-resistant weed management, developing these decision support tools for adaptive nitrogen management. And where we're going with this is now we're working with Miguel Cabrera and his group down in Georgia, where we have this really large project across the mid-Atlantic and the Southeast to look at just quality and quantity, but the quality is looking at forage quality measures. So the lignin, the cellulose, the ADFs, all these different measures of forage quality give a better handle on how these products are going to behave and decompose. And so we're going to be working with them in their model, calibrating and validating and calibrating these models, and then hopefully this will then translate into decision support tools that can be working with real-time weather data. So if a farmer has a really wet spring or a very dry spring, we can have understanding of the decomposition kinetics of the cover crops and be able to make recommendations about their side dress applications. This is a really important one. The Penn State group is certainly doing a lot around this as well, but just knowing how initial state conditions drive performance. We need to be able to understand how these cover crop mixtures behave, how the initial state conditions and climate drive that, and then, as important, we need to know how landscape features influence these dynamics. And there was a great talk in a graduate student presentation session of the cover crops where they were looking at landscape features and how that drove performance. And if we're going to scale up these questions and be working with folks who are watershed modelers and asking, what if questions about what cover crops can do in the landscape, we need to not just understand all this nuance at the plot scale, but just how the slope, how drainage and all these factors drive performance so we can make better estimations of the potential benefits of cover crops. And lastly, is we are also trying to just improve the genetic material that we're working with. So this is a big team. I know I've missed a bunch of people, I'm sure, but it gives you a sense of some of the people who have been involved in these projects over the years and some of the funding streams that we've got to help support this effort. So thank you.